Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Solidarity Journal on WAZU, all the news and views from left of center. I'm Zach, and with us is Mike Perillo. Chances are he'll be co-hosting with me every week.
Good morning, Zach. I'm looking forward to doing future reports.
Today we have nuclear energy, Wisconsin labor news, Peoria City Council elections, Springfield recent budget proposals, and much more. Stay tuned. More news is next. Another corporate scam. Another story of bad gone wrong. Another corporate bailout. Another piece of the pie. It's the best democracy money can buy. They rig the elections. And only millionaires can play. And you gotta be cynical. You gotta look into the camera and say, I'm serving the public. When you know it's a corporate lie, but it's the best democracy money can buy. In Wisconsin labor news, a Dane County judge, Mary Ann Sumi, ruled Thursday, March 31st, that Wisconsin's controversial budget repair bill has not been published and is not in effect.
In Wisconsin, a Dane County judge reaffirmed Thursday that her order against the bill gutting collective bargaining for public workers blocks implementation of the law. Republican Governor Scott Walker's regime has defied the order by going ahead with implementation of the law. But Thursday, State Department of Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch said implementation was suspended based on Judge Mary Ann Sumi's order. Legal challenges to the anti-union bill by the mayor of Madison, the county executive of Dane County, and by the firefighters and other unions have at least temporarily blocked the bill from actually becoming law. Walker's administration began to implement the law anyway, though, after it was published by the state's Legislative Reference Bureau, which is required to publish laws when they pass the legislature. But even the head of that bureau says that the law doesn't actually go into effect until Wisconsin's Secretary of State publishes the law. The judge has blocked that. Judge Sumi declared on Thursday that this bill gutting collective bargaining in Wisconsin is not in effect. This newscast, made possible by the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers, Iron Ship Builders, Blacksmiths, Forgers, and Helpers. And by the AFL-CIO, America's Labor Movement.
The bill prohibits public employees from collectively bargaining for anything other than salary and imposes other obstacles to unionization, such as requiring yearly votes for workers to keep their union. When Democratic lawmakers fled the state to deny Republicans a quorum, the state's Republican majority amended the bill to declare that it was not a fiscal bill, and so did not require a quorum. Legislative rules require a quorum only on fiscal budgetary bills. Dane County District Attorney then sued the state, saying the legislative trick violated Wisconsin's open meeting laws. Judge Sumi stopped the Secretary of State from publishing the bill, which is the first step necessary for it to take effect. In response, the Republican majority had the Legislative Reference Bureau publish it late last week. Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin and his party declared that that made the law effective last Saturday. But Judge Sumi said Thursday the 31st that isn't so. Based on the briefs of counsel, the uncontroverted testimony, and the evidence received at the March 29, 2011 evidentiary hearing, it is hereby declared that the 2011 Wisconsin Act 10 has not been published within the meaning of Wisconsin statutes and is therefore not in effect. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Governor Walker stopped collecting dues for state unions and began charging state employees more for their health care and pensions on Sunday. It appears that will have to stop for now, thanks to Judge Sumi. More hearings are scheduled. The bill also faces a constitutional challenge in a separate court. You can hear more news on this story and other labor-related issues right here on WAZU 90.7 FM, weeknights at 11 p.m. till midnight on The Union Edge, a program of the Working Family Radio Network. And every Saturday at 11 a.m. you can tune in and hear the Illinois World Labor Hour, a program of WEFT 90.1 FM Champaign, which we simulcast with. Here at WAZU, we offer the best in labor and working class news. Just a reminder, you're listening to WAZU 90.7 FM, a service of Illinois Central College, and Peoria's only Pacifica Radio affiliate, featuring Democracy Now and the Free Speech Radio Network. Join the ladies' auxiliary.
married life ain't hard. You're packing a union card. And a married man has a happy life if he's got a union wife. So you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union. Oh, you can't scare me. I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union until the day I die. Oh.
The United States has lessened its standards on nuclear power safety. During the chaos of earthquake, aftershocks, and tsunamis, the nuclear power plant in Fukushima, Japan, was offline, and power needed to cool the reactor failed, causing a hydrogen explosion from the reactor core. The industry and governments have known of this potential since the advent of nuclear energy in the 40s and 50s. After the Three Mile Island incident of 1979, which was the most significant nuclear power accident of American history to date, many reactors were required to install hydrogen recombiners, which attach potential explosive hydrogen atoms to oxygen to make water instead of deadly, potentially explosive gas. At Three Mile Island, engineers learned that hot fuel could interact with steam to give off hydrogen. That caused the plant's reactor to suffer a hydrogen explosion, although it did not seriously damage its containment. By contrast, Fukushima containment walls blew due to hydrogen buildup. Since the requirement of hydrogen combiners after the Three Mile Island incident, and decades of time have gone by, Japan's present disaster causes Americans to look into the state of our nuclear energy policy. Nuclear safety critics have brought into question the changes in policy by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the United States. Changes that have brought about the elimination of hydrogen recombiners, which safeguard against hydrogen buildup and explosion. The United States has lessened its standards. All the while, we've seen in the media and online images of the crisis in Japan. And do we really believe we are safe from a situation like that? I'd say some of us do. I'd say that in our limited questioning, and our limited desire to better understand and desire for change in our energy consumption and production, we allow hazardous energy policies to go unchecked. It's only a matter of time. Do we believe we are safe from the effects of Mother Nature? Do we believe we are special and what happens around the world cannot and won't happen to us? How can an industry so risky go on with a move like this? Where is government regulation and safety requirements and standards? I took a political science class here at ICC, and I learned about capture theory. I'll tell you a little about it. It's a theory whereby a regulatory agency of the government, which is formed to serve the people, just as any branch or function of a governing body here in the United States, is captured by the industry or marketplace which it was formed to regulate. Upon control of this sometimes legislative body, which was designed to keep limits or standards on the industry it regulates, this agency now does the will of the industry in the halls of power, in Congress, in courts, in the very function of governing. The desires of that industry to grow, profit, maintain profitability, limit competition, lower costs, can now be laws, or can become a standard at any expense. Looking at the elimination of a safety standard in nuclear power, I have to ask myself, was this done to maintain profits, to keep costs down? And if so, how did the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allow such a policy? I immediately think of capture theory. Private nuclear power industry leaders have either become members of this governing body, and they clearly don't do what's in the interest of the people, and in fact form policy that agrees with the corporate desires of the private industry. For a regulatory agency to be effective, it has to be impartial and made up of people who don't have a vested interest in the outcome of policymaking, seeking only the betterment of every other man and woman and child in the country. Agency members need to be at the service of the people, not at the service of the industry. Capitalist industries only want one thing, and I learned this in economics class at ICC. To lower costs and increase revenues. That's all they want to do. And they will do that at the expense of lives or safety. Nothing can stand in their way if they can help it. And that is why regulatory agencies become compromised. There are more than 80 anti-nuclear groups in the United States, and Illinois has 6 nuclear power plants operational. More than 200,000 Germans marched against nuclear power in Berlin, March 26th of this year. People don't like it. It's a real issue of our time. Impartiality in our government is another issue. Local announcements and current events. Saturday, April 9th, Illinois Sustainable Living and Wellness Expo, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Illinois Wesleyan University. Thursday, April 7th, in Peoria at 6 o'clock, 6 p.m. at the former Holiday Inn Brandywine Hotel, there will be a public hearing concerning the proposed expansion of the Peoria Disposal Company landfill. The Sierra Club and the Global Warming Solutions Group request that people attend whether or not they want to speak. That's April 7th. Also on that day in Bloomington is the monthly anti-war demonstration in downtown Bloomington in front of the Center for the Performing Arts at 5:30 p.m. Tuesday, April 12th in Peoria at 4 p.m. at Bradley University Library, a Bradley University Marketing Adjunct Professor, Henry Belfans, will give a presentation on Betty Friedan and Janita Rankin. Betty Friedan is well known for her work in women's rights. Janita Rankin was the first female member of Congress, before most women even had the right to vote. She is best known as a pacifist, voting against entering World Wars I and II. For more information, contact Carol Rhodes at 677-2610.
AFSCME, the American Federal State County Municipal Employees, are holding a nationwide week of action, scheduled for April 4th through the 9th, to speak out against the assault on workers' rights across the country. These We Are One rallies will be held across the state during the week. Buildings to Saturday's All Illinois Rally in Chicago, the AFL-CIO's call for a nationwide outpouring of resistance to the assault on collective bargaining during the week of April 4th, echoes a historic struggle in the battle for basic human rights. Also, yesterday, April 4th, was the tragic 43-year anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. assassination in Memphis, where he had gone to stand with sanitation workers demanding their dream, the right to bargain collectively for a voice at work and a better life. Today, the same demand is electrifying people across America. It's the demand of all people, the right to join together for our common dreams. The battles to defend collective bargaining in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, Missouri, Florida, and other states have galvanized the labor movement and brought hundreds of thousands to our cause. Working together with the state, AFL-CIO, and the Chicago Federation of Labor, AFSCME has helped develop a plan of action for the week of April 4th that can unify all of labor and also build broad participation from supporters in our communities. The plan calls for a massive all-Illinois rally in Chicago on Saturday, April 9th, with building block rallies in key cities throughout the state that week. Yesterday, Monday, April 4th, AFSCME held rallies in Champaign, Decatur, Kankakee, Ottawa, Peoria, Rock Island, and Rockford. Tomorrow, Wednesday, April 6th, more rallies will be happening in Collinsville, at the IBEW Hall in Room 300 on 2000 Mall Street at 5:30 p.m. And also in Bloomington at the Central Labor Council, meeting is open to all working families. On Thursday, April 7th, Peoria will have a rally at the County Courthouse from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Springfield will have a rally as well at the Illinois State Capitol at 5 p.m. And Gurnee will have its rally at the IFT Local 504 Hall from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. On Friday, April 8th, in Carbondale, the SIU Arena will be holding a rally at 6 p.m. And then Saturday, April 9th, Chicago will have a rally at the Daly Plaza at 1 p.m. Meet at noon at the Thompson Center to march with AFSCME to the big rally. For more information on the week of rallies, please visit www.afscme31.org.
The rivers will flow into the Charles. and the Rio Bravo. The nuke dumps will widen and the forests will burn until the time comes when we finally learn that whoever wins in November, neo-lib, neo-con, stands only for death. Whichever face he has on, we will build a new world and set us all free. Once we drive the whole lot of them right out of D.C. Whoever wins in November, know all your enemies. We know our enemies.
In other news, in the past 2 weeks of March, in efforts to reduce its $11 million deficit that the state of Illinois owes District 300, the Community Unit School Board in Carpentersville announced that it would hold a vote in deciding whether 363 teachers would be laid off. The teachers' union, LEAD, would also need to make concessions to their $5.2 million wage, benefits, and insurance before their contract expires in June. This would slash $8.3 million from the school's budget, finishing the current school year with a $5 million deficit and making it possible to rehire half of the school's staff. President of the teachers' union, Colleen Hantho, said the group is willing to work with the district, stating that, "We have been asking to come to the table, and that the loss of this number of teachers will destroy the education of the students of District 300. If those concessions are not reached, the district's Plan B could face a $22 million deficit, including having to cut around 94 employees, shortening the school day for middle and high schools, discontinuing its Preschool for All program, and closing Oak Ridge. Regardless of the concessions, electives and extracurricular activities would be cut. With cutting classes and having students' numbers remaining the same, each classroom will become overcrowded. This will create a much more difficult environment for teachers to attend." When the scheduled board meeting finally arrived on March 23rd, more than 1,200 students, teachers, parents, and other community members were in attendance, ready to plead with the board not to vote for the cuts. According to the policy manual, Board President Joe Stevens decided that each person would only receive 1 minute of testimony, which effectively censored out the community's full discourse. After 80 individuals laid bare their views with genuine and heated statements in support for their teachers, the board convened for a few minutes, then narrowly approved with a 43 vote to release the teachers. As some in the audience inside the packed Westfield High School gymnasium wept and listened in silence to the decision made, one woman stated plainly, "I just lost my job." Days before and after the vote, students were moved to organize a brief walkout from their schools during advisory periods in protest. Throughout the week, hundreds of students at Dundee Crown High School, along with Hampshire and Jacobs, assembled outside their schools, chanting "Save our teachers" and "Save our schools" while holding signs that read, "I weep for our future." Mike Kelly, a 17-year-old senior from Algonquin, stated, "We want to make it clear to the school board that we are not okay with cutting a lot of the teachers." But District 300 spokeswoman Allison Strupek said that the protests weren't a new Dundee Crown tradition. Walkouts happened before when similar cuts were put up for a vote last year. Dundee Crown Principal Lynn McCarthy said while the school is supportive of students' social awareness, that future protests would not be tolerated. These types of statements and actions by the state and school administrations reveal how deeply corrupted and anemic they have become. The long-term effects of stripping away the students' incentives to not challenge, but to accept with blind obedience the very system that is exploiting them, will only undermine their ability to criticize and demonstrate. Students at District 300, as well as everywhere else, need to understand that becoming active and committing themselves to nonviolent direct action needs to happen now. Job cuts in response to budgets will not go without community involvement, which is clear by the strong opinions expressed by students and parents in District 300.
Will you fight for a better place with me till the end of this story? Oh, when it all gets written again. Oh, when it all gets written again. And things will never be the same. And things will never be the same. And things will never be the same. Oh, you can feel that constant change. Oh, things will never be the same for me, my friends.
Illinois House, Senate, and Quinn's budget battle. Governor Pat Quinn says any budget plans being floated by lawmakers must include significant funding for education. Quinn's comments come Thursday after the Democrat and Republican leaders in the Illinois House drew up a budget outline that would cut state education funding by $200 million. Another $400 million in federal funds could also disappear. Quinn wants to see cash increases to education, not cuts. Members of the State House, State Senate, and Governor's Office all have come up with different projections of how much revenue state government will take in for fiscal year 2012. The House is proposing yearly revenues at $33.2 billion and is constructing a budget around that figure. The Senate estimates revenues to be $34.3 billion and is forming budget proposals around that goal. Quinn's proposed revenues are $33.9 billion. He and his constituents are building a budget based on that. The new budget year begins July 1st. The Assembly and the Governor have some time to hash this out and come up with a solid budget for this next fiscal year of 2012. A bipartisan agreement was made in the House, which might seem like clear fiscal logic, but the idea of bipartisanship is a stark departure from recent years, where Quinn and fellow Democrats huddled privately on spending matters and Republicans largely voted against whatever the other party proposed. The House explained that it will produce a budget based on its revenue estimates and not the higher numbers used by the Senate and Governor. That will mean significant cuts to some programs. Under the House outline, education would be cut $200 million. Quinn's budget plan called for education spending to increase. When the Senate and the House can't come to some kind of agreement on a specific bill, five members from each chamber meet and try to hammer out details in a conference meeting. Since the House's $33.2 billion revenue projection is more conservative than the Senate's $34.3 billion projection, Madigan said Senate Republicans might be inclined to side with the House if such a 10-member meeting should arise. After 2 years of giving Governor Pat Quinn a lump-sum budget and allowing him to make most budgeting decisions, the House and Senate appeared to be gearing up to take a more active role in piecing together a spending plan for the coming year. Meantime, dozens of lobbying groups circulated through the Capitol Wednesday, March 30th, calling on lawmakers to reverse cuts proposed by Quinn. Quinn might be a fan of education, but his proposals to reduce Medicare spending by $552 million could result in delays to bricks and mortar improvements and limit access to health care for citizens of Illinois. Assembly members in both the House and Senate are feeling the pressure to reject these cuts in Quinn's proposed budgets, and both have formed their own rival budgets against Quinn. Illinois House leaders are pushing forward with a budget plan that would ignore many of the governor's spending proposals, and at the same time, bankrupting schools, cutting $200 million in spending to Illinois schools. Overall, education funding could be cut by as much as $600 million under the House plan if the federal government does not renew up to $400 million in special stimulus funds that helped counter the effects of the recession. The Senate is proposing $6 billion in cuts to the Illinois state budget, along with a $2 billion margin of error in their budget. Chances are the House will pass our state budget, and it seems to be at the expense of public schools. But don't take my word for it. Keep an eye out on this story.
And we rock, because us against them, we found our own reasons to sing. And it's so much less confusing when lines are drawn like that. When people are either consumers or revolutionaries, enemies or friends hanging on the fringes of the cogs in the system. It's just about knowing where everyone stands. All of a sudden,
people start talking about guns, talking like they're going to war. Cause they found something to die for. Start taking back what they stole.
Here in Peoria, city council elections are gearing up, and one of our local interest groups, the Global Warming Solutions Group, delivered a survey to the candidates, asking them 5 questions relating to sustainability issues ranging from recycling to climate change. The Global Warming Solutions Group advocates for practical solutions to the problems posed by global warming. This local interest group is a coalition of individuals and organizations interested in a more sustainable Central Illinois. They actively work to encourage energy conservation, increase recycling, and promote renewable energy opportunities. Global Warming Solutions successfully lobbied the Peoria City Council for both free curbside recycling and the Revolving Energy Fund. This group developed a survey of questions which they provided to the candidates for City Council, offering them a platform to share their views on sustainability issues. Global Warming Solutions promised to publish the candidates' answers online and in a press release to local at-large media. 8 out of the 10 candidates responded. Only Eric Turner, the incumbent, and George Azuri didn't respond. This is a summary of the answers provided by the Global Warming Solutions Group. Questions range from PDC, achievements, landfill expansions, global warming and climate change, plans to make our community more sustainable, and what actions have the candidates personally taken to make their own lives more sustainable. Candidates' responses in regards to Peoria Disposal Company becoming the city's waste hauler and offering free curbside recycling. PDC was targeting 30% participation. Right now, 1 year later, there are around 15% of Peoria households participate in the free curbside recycling. When the candidates were asked what should be done to increase participation, all candidates expressed support for recycling, and many suggested education and incentives. Candidate Sandberg would increase recycling pickup frequency and pay for it by reducing yard waste pickups. Spain would fund increased recycling pickups by replacing waste management as the landfill operator, a move he believes would save the city $350,000 a year. Summers supports a pay-as-you-throw model with free, more frequent recycling pickups. Axon would study mandatory recycling programs in other cities and look at requiring landlords to provide recycling for all tenants. Because as of right now, renters do not have the ability to have the free curbside recycling program. It's only for households in neighborhoods and homeowners. Candidates were given the opportunity to respond about the proposed piggyback expansion of the city, county, municipal waste landfill. When PDC won the landfill contract, it proposed the 10 million ton standalone expansion. Now, alternative designs under consideration include an 18 million ton expansion piggybacked on top of the existing landfill, projected to create landfill capacity through the year 2070. Graeb, Sandberg, and Axon share the environmental community's concerns about the long-term integrity of a piggyback landfill. Sandberg also points out that creating excess capacity drives the wrong behavior, buying waste instead of reusing and recycling. Neither Stowell nor Summers believe Peoria should be taking waste from other communities. Weaver, Williams, and Spain all see the need for further study. When candidates were asked whether or not they believed human activities are the most significant contributing factor to the very real threat of abrupt and disruptive climate change, 5 candidates gave an unequivocal yes. Weaver and Williams did not fully commit to the belief, but emphasized that regardless of whether climate change is human-caused or not, we must act. Summers flatly answered no. He does not believe that human activities contributing factor to climate change, but shared his belief that humans need to be better stewards of the environment. Everyone recognizes that with the long-term fiscal outlook, that there will be very limited local, state, and federal funds for making Peoria more sustainable. Candidates were asked how Peoria could be more competitive for these scarce funds, and how to best utilize existing tools, such as the Energy Efficiency Revolving Fund. Many candidates indicated the need for a shared vision and a local approach. Sandberg believes that government is not the solution. Using the example of a decision to subsidize downtown parking rather than promote mass transit, Spain pointed to his track record of securing scarce funds for initiatives such as sustainable streetscapes, stormwater management, and alternative energy. Summers and Akison, both vocal proponents of the To Combat Sprawl, see dense, walkable neighborhoods as a route to sustainability. Weaver suggests using a global conscience to determine where sustainability funds are best spent, even if it is not Peoria. All eight candidates have made personal lifestyle changes. 7 of 8 recycle. Grabe and Spain drive hybrids. Williams and his wife share a car. Sandberg drives his 50-mile-per-gallon motorcycle year-round. Grabe and Weaver have both made energy efficiency improvements in buildings they own. Sandberg keeps his carbon footprint small in a 1,000-square-foot home and uses his single-room air conditioner fewer than 10 nights a year. Akison made the decision to send only one campaign mailing, keeping excess campaign literature out of the landfill. Global Warming Solutions Group thanks the responding candidates for their thoughtful answers and looks forward to working with the new council to make Peoria a more sustainable community. The candidate survey was intended as a public education tool, not to endorse any particular candidate.
A once great nation's fallen ill. A schoolyard bully hooked on pills, with one hand down the Bible and a hand inside the till. Whatever will be, my friends will be. We're just a common man.
Well, in environmental news, the federal government has awarded Shell Offshore Inc. the first new deepwater oil exploration plan approved since the BP Deepwater Horizon explosion in April 2010. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar and Michael Bromwich, Director of the Interior's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Regulation and Enforcement, said that the Bureau approved Shell's exploration plan following the completion of a site-specific environmental assessment for deepwater oil and gas exploration. You know, personally, I am sick and tired of believing in regulators and governments who put their faith in capitalist mechanisms and who time after time get bought out and buckle at the expense of the American people, the integrity of our lands, and our environment. Speaking on the approved Shell plan, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar said, "This exploration meets the new standards for environmental review and marks another important step towards safer deepwater exploration." Shell's exploration plan is for its leased Auger field, located 130 miles off the Louisiana coastline. The company wants to drill 3 exploratory wells in nearly 3,000 feet of water. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal said, "This is a good first step, but we must quickly get to a level of issuing permits that represents a critical mass so thousands of oil and gas industry workers can get back to fueling America again." We have to question why. Why are these workers the Louisiana governor is thinking so much about not finding jobs and maintaining offshore solar capturing rigs or wind or hydroelectric energy? Why are greedy capitalists selling non-renewable resources without regulation? New environmental standards have been created in lessons learned from BP. Why should governments enforce these energy companies to spend money on forming better safety standards instead of demanding and enforcing they use some of their profits on research and development and implementation and use of renewable energy sources? Well, this has environmental groups up in arms, and none of them are really sure of the condition the Gulf will be under while new deepwater oil exploration resumes. And again, I cannot help but consider governmental impartiality, or the lack thereof, being one of the reasons that something like this is even happening. I have to consider, if governments have the power to enforce safety standards on oil rigs in anything, they have the power to enforce law, then they should make laws that help companies create renewable energy resources. Plain and simple. That's all they have to do. Subsidies for clean energy. Stop paying subsidies for dirty energy. Government should need to do the will of the people and not greedy capitalists. Oh, so much bad news out there. And it's sad I have to bring another story. The Welfare Reform Act of 2011 in the United States Congress. A seemingly Tea Party-backed bill. Of the five representatives introducing the bill, all five of them can be researched online as supporting the Tea Party movement. This is H.R. 1135. And there's a buried provision in the House GOP bill, which would cut off food stamps to entire families if one family member strikes. If one family member strikes at his job, her job, the whole family loses food stamps. All around the country, right-wing legislators are asking middle-class Americans to pay for budget deficits caused from decades in tax revenues due to demands to deregulate markets outcried from the wealthiest among us. Republicans are attacking workers' collective bargaining rights in the hope that money not paid to workers can solve budget deficits and keep the wealthiest from paying taxes. All of this has provoked a huge Main Street movement to fight back. Now, a group of House Republicans is launching a new stealth attack against union workers. GOP representatives Jim Jordan of Ohio, Tim Scott of South Carolina, Scott Garrett of New Jersey, Dan Burton of Indiana, and Louis Gohmert of Texas have introduced H.R. 1135, which states that it is designed to provide information on total spending on means-tested welfare programs, to provide additional work requirements to welfare recipients, and to provide an overall spending limit on means-tested welfare programs for the federal government. Much of the bill is based upon verifying that those who receive food stamps are meeting the federal requirements for doing so. However, one section buried deep within the bill adds a startling new requirement. The bill, if passed, would actually cut off all food stamps and benefits to any family where one adult member of the family is engaging in a strike against an employer. They have proposed to make it a law that if your mom or dad go on strike in conjunction with a dispute over collective bargaining, then the state has a right to deny needy children food stamps. Busting workers for trying to improve their workplace and controlling the poor are two of the Republican Party's favorite pastimes. So it's no surprise that they've found a way to do both in this proposal. Representative Jim Gordon, the Republican from Ohio, he's the chairman of the Conservative Republican Study Committee, introduced the misnamed Welfare Reform Act of 2011, which would cut funding for the vast majority of programs for low and moderate income families to 2007 funding levels. If unemployment falls below 6.5% nationally, the bill essentially misrepresents dozens of popular programs as welfare programs to garner support for large cuts. Affected programs include Medicaid, SNAP, Child Care, Head Start, Title I education funding, community development block grants, job training and community health centers. In addition to automatic cuts for 77 programs, H.R. 1135 would make sweeping changes to SNAP, including repealing the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act's SNAP benefit increase, instituting punitive work requirements with harsh sanctions, and repealing the right to continue to receive food aid while engaged in an appeal of an administrative action, aka striking. It is unlikely this bill will move in Congress, but elements could be included in other legislation. Man, that really ticks me off. Just having to hear bad news like that has just ruined my afternoon, ruined my day, but hopefully it's not going to ruin yours. Because I know once I leave the studio, get into the car, start driving down the local streets, I'll be rejuvenated, and I'll feel positive again, and I'll take all these desires that I want to see these things not to happen. I'll take all these desires that I have to force change, and I'll live a better life. and I'll share it with people around me, I'll share it with my community, and in doing so, by having all these blatant, rude things become part of our life through government and through policy, we're able to understand what not to do and how to live better. Thanks for listening to Solidarity Journal and WAZU, your Peoria community radio station, your one and only Pacifica Radio Network affiliate. Don't forget our national and local programming such as Harvesting Dreams, Monday through Thursday, 1 o'clock to 2 p.m. The New Movement, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. Live with Loving Good, Fridays, 1 to 3 p.m. Strictly Hip Hop, Monday through Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. and more. Never forgetting to remind you, this is your home for great national Pacifica radio programming. In Peoria, make 90.7 your number one preset in your car. For the best in national news programming, as always, remember, this station runs with feedback and input from you. This is your home for local information and participation. Thanks for listening. And being that it's Tuesday, and yesterday was April 4th, that's the 43-year anniversary of the Martin Luther King assassination. A great man, great speaker, and we only touched on him partially in a current events story we had 35 minutes ago. But I'd like to leave us with the solemn words of Bobby Kennedy as he talks about the tragedy of losing such a great man.
I speak to you under different circumstances than I had intended to just 24 hours ago. But this is a time of shame and a time of sorrow. It is not a day for politics. I have saved this one opportunity, my only event of today, to speak briefly to you about the mindless menace of violence in America, which again stains our land and every one of our lives. It is not the concern of any one race. The victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why? What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people. Whenever any American's life is taken by another American unnecessarily, whether it is done in the name of the law or in defiance of the law, by one man or by a gang, in cold blood or in passion, in an attack of violence or in response to violence, whenever we tear at the fabric of our lives, which another man has painfully and clumsily woven for himself and his children, whenever we do this, then the whole nation is degraded. Among free men, said Abraham Lincoln, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. And those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Yet we seemingly tolerate a rising level of violence that ignores our common humanity and our claims to civilization alike. We calmly accept newspaper reports of civilian slaughter in far-off lands. We glorify killing on movie and television screens, and we call it entertainment. We'd make it easier for men of all shades of sanity to acquire weapons and ammunition that they desire. Too often we honor swagger and bluster and the wielders of force. Too often we excuse those who are willing to build their own lives on the shattered dreams of other human beings. Some Americans who preach nonviolence abroad fail to practice it here at home. Some accuse others of rioting and inciting riots, have by their own conduct invited them. Some look for scapegoats. Others look for conspiracies. But this much is clear. Violence breeds violence. Repression breeds retaliation. And only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls. For there is another kind of violence, slower, but just as deadly destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence of institutions, indifference, inaction, and decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter. This is the breaking of a man's spirit by denying him the chance to stand as a father and as a man amongst other men. And this, too, afflicts us all. For when you teach a man to hate and to fear his brother, when you teach that he is a lesser man because of his color or his beliefs or the policies that he pursues, when you teach that those who differ from you threaten your freedom or your job or your home or your family, then you also learn to confront others, not as fellow citizens, but as enemies, to be met not with cooperation, but with conquest, to be subjugated and to be mastered. We learn at the last to look at our brothers as alien men with whom we share a city, but not a community. Men bound to us in common dwelling, but not in a common effort. We learn to share only a common fear, only a common desire to retreat from each other, only a common impulse to meet disagreement with force. For all this, there are no final answers for those of us who are American citizens. Yet we know what we must do, and that is to achieve true justice among all of our fellow citizens. The question is not what programs we should seek to enact. The question is whether we can find in our own midst and in our own hearts that leadership of humane purpose that will recognize the terrible truths of our existence. We must admit the vanity of our false distinctions, the false distinctions among men, and learn to find our own advancement and search for the advancement of all. We must admit to ourselves that our children's future cannot be built on the misfortune of another's. We must recognize that this short life can neither be ennobled or enriched by hatred or by revenge. Our lives on this planet are too short. The work to be done is too great to let this spirit flourish any longer in this land of ours. Of course, we cannot banish it with a program, nor with a resolution. But we can perhaps remember, if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as do we, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and in happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment that they can. Surely this bond of common fate, surely this bond of common goals can begin to teach us something. Surely we can learn at the least to look around at those of us, of our fellow men, and surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our hearts brothers and countrymen once again. Tennyson wrote in Ulysses, "That which we are, one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." Thank you very much.